Hey guys, how the hell are you? What's going on? Yeah, no. Greetings. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Not heavy on production values here on the show. I don't have a bunch of, fancy intros and sound effects and this and that. I'm just trying to be myself and point my finger at things I want to accuse. Mostly that's libertarian foreign policy coverage. A lot of cop hatred, too. That's about it. Some economics and history and whatever, but, libertarian foreign policy, mostly. And, well, I just remembered to blog today's show, so there, it's blogged now at scotthorton.org/stress. That's my blog. If you want to join up the chat room, it's scotthorton.org/chat. That's pretty easy. It's a IRC free node chat room. But you can just use a plain old browser window. You don't need any external application or program or anything to use it. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat, fake name and a captcha, and you're in. Say hey to everybody. Hey, everybody. And there you go. You can talk about El Caminos or whatever you want during the show. Today on the show, Dean Ahmad is going to be back. I wasn't really organized enough when I interviewed him last. And we kind of jumped around too much from the right of return and the Nakba and the current war and the this and the that. But, I wanted to let him tell his story about his own family. And also wanted to talk with him a little bit more, well, speaking of skipping around, a little bit more about what's been going on in Gaza recently, where we're at now. It looks like there really is a new ceasefire, as we talked about yesterday on the show. Let me make sure. Quiet in Gaza. That's Eric Garris on the IM there. Make sure I'm right about everything in real time if I need to check. I believe it is holding so far. Also, Landay's going to be on the show. He's from McClatchy Newspapers. Great reporter there. And he's going to be on to talk about, the state of the Islamic State over there in Sunnistan, as well as the politics in Washington, D.C. I saw a clip of him on the Maddow show, and it's the first time I've watched Maddow in forever. Luckily, Landay talks so damn much, she could barely get a word in edgewise. I just can't stand to hear her voice anymore. I would rather listen to Rand Paul or Sarah Palin talk. I just can't stand it. But Landay talked mostly the whole time. And really, he was kind of going through which all administration officials had threatened what and then compared to what they seemed to be ready to do. And, it's a big complicated mess. I mean, I don't know. We all know that CIA and SOCOM and JSOC have been building up in Iraq, up in Kurdistan, since June. And we know there have been a lot of airstrikes over there, too. But just how far they're willing to go into Syria, just how far they're willing to go into Sunnistan to fight this thing, I don't know. I don't think Landay knows either, but I would like his best estimate of, what we know so far about, who's over there and what they're doing. Some reports have Special Air Services and JSOC, that's British and American top-tier special forces, on the ground over there hunting the guys, hunting the guy in the video, and then I guess the Brits and other leaders. They want to get rid of the Brits because it's bad PR that they have a group of jihadists over there cutting people's heads off who are named after the Beatles. They want to get that taken care of. The people who killed James Foley, they got to go. But then Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com had a story about how when it comes to hunting down the leaders of al-Nusra, of ISIS and killing them, they don't really know who they are, where they are. They really don't have any intel at all. And they know who Baghdadi is. They don't know where he is. And they're reportedly, they're just going off of the videos like amateur Kremlinologists saying, well, we keep seeing this guy in the video, so he must be a leader. That kind of thing. But, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so that's why Lande is going to be on the show to talk about that. As long as I'm talking about it, I want to point out Obama yesterday. And this is Leslie Clark, again, at McClatchy Newspapers. Obama vows justice for Foley, but no boots on the ground. He's been saying this over and over again here. This paragraph reads, quote, "But he pledged that U.S. intervention wouldn't include troops on the ground, saying, quote, let me say it again." Jesus, he sounds exactly like Franklin Roosevelt here. "Let me say it again. American combat troops will not be returning to fight in Iraq. We'll not allow," this is still quoting the president, "we'll not allow the United States to be dragged back into another ground war in Iraq." I'm just not sure what to make of that statement. I mean, I can think of so many horrible things to say about Barack Obama, but he is more intelligent than George W. Bush. And I think he does understand that the strategy always was to get us to overreact, invade, bog ourselves down, radicalize a generation, waste trillions of dollars. Doesn't mean he's a good person or he's going to, you know, act contrary to that all the time. But, I mean, come on. He's the president and he's not George Bush and he's lived through all this. He's got to understand by now that really going back to Iraq is what the Islamic State wants. It's what they want, is to be fighting the U.S. That's why Michael Scheuer said, you know, Bin Laden's plan, well, that Bin Laden himself said, the plan was to drag us into Afghanistan, bog us down fighting in Afghanistan, bankrupt us fighting in Afghanistan, go into Iraq and overthrowing Saddam of the green jacket and the clean-shaven chin and the black beret, the secular, basically European-style fascist, Baathist military dictator of Iraq, overthrowing him and turning all of the North and West into jihadistan. Why, that was the, quote, hoped for but unexpected gift to Bin Laden. And as Zawahiri put it a few years later, hey, see if you can get them into a war with Iran. Anything, man, if you could get the Americans to take out the Ayatollahs in Iran for us, that would be great, said Ehud Olmert and Benjamin Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon's half a corpse and Ayman al-Zawahiri all at the same time back in about 2006. But anyway, so just keep doing our dirty work. Take out Gaddafi, take out Assad, or even, you know, launch this war against Assad, back this Mujahideen war against Assad. You know, even when in 2011, when Jeff Huber wrote Bin Laden dead and loving it, he could have never predicted. Or I don't know, I guess I shouldn't speak too soon about that. I should go back and check and see exactly what Jeff Huber was writing. He may well have already been covering this in 2011. And he died shortly after Bin Laden was killed, actually, in, I guess, early that summer. Jeff Huber died. But could any of us have imagined, I guess, yeah, that... really, that they would just kind of outright back proclaimed veterans of the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria this way? Yeah, sure. I mean, hell, Seymour Hersh wrote the redirection back in 07, so... But to this degree, to where it's the most obvious, most blatant, highest of treason for two straight years back in Bin Ladenites in Syria like this, in both Libya and Syria, I don't know. It's just amazing. But, I don't know. See, here's what I think. I think when Obama talks like this, it's one, a measure of the fact that he really does know better. And it's also a clue that he's going to do exactly what he swears he's not going to do here. I mean, he could be directly paraphrasing, directly quoting Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt here, promising that we are not getting into the world wars. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys. So coming up, Dean Ahmad on Palestine. Later, Jonathan Lande on the Islamic State. And I'm working on getting Jason Ditz to talk about Ukraine, but I haven't reached him yet. But there's so much going on in eastern Ukraine we need to cover here. But actually, regardless, I got some Ukraine stories to go over with you. Either way. Oh, all right. It is the Scott Horton Show. Say Thursday or Wednesday? That's only Wednesday, right? Yeah. Okay. Never mind. All right. Listen, so we got to talk about the police state. This story broke yesterday on the show. You heard me kind of interrupt the MJ Rosenberg interview to complain about it. Oh, Garris answers me, by the way. Yes, quiet in Gaza right now. Still. So, good. But yeah, so the police state. This story broke yesterday, and it is just the most horrible thing in the whole wide world. I can't get over it. How horrible this could be. How horrible it is already. Because of how horrible, really, it could be. And that is a call by many prominent liberal and progressive groups for a federal czar to oversee local police forces. Now, there's so many damn points to make here. It's not like I wrote out an essay to read to you like Jim Hightower or anything. I'm just kind of going off the cuff here. But the first thing is that this just proves that libertarians are right about the economics of bureaucracy. That's the name of the book by Ludwig von Mises, Bureaucracy. And in government, because they have a monopoly, whenever they fail, they win. No matter how horrible they are, they win. If, say, take for example the national government's greatest single day failure ever, September 11th. You can go on and on in your own imagination and mind and whatever about whatever reasons, but they sure as hell did not stop that attack that day, did they? But that's okay. They got to have as many wars as they wanted. They got to have a Patriot Act. They got to have all new executive orders. They got to create a Department of Homeland Security. They got to really initiate and solidify the doctrine of the unitary executive and the inherent and plenary authority of the president in wartime to torture people to death, to kidnap them, to turn them over to Hosni Mubarak or Bashar al-Assad to be tortured to death, or break any law that they wanted. It doesn't matter. That is their damn fault. They picked the fight, and then they failed to protect us from the danger that they created for us, and then they benefited in 10,000 ways anyway. Now here, the police killed an unarmed black man. And so, are they fired? Local police, you're fired. We are going to set about to create new safeguards for our liberty and security, like it says in the Declaration of Independence. We don't like you anymore. And we want to hire ADT security now. No. The blacks of Ferguson don't get to choose their security force. Their security force chooses them. And that's why it's not a security force at all. Well, security for somebody, but not for the people it's ruling over at all. And so, but that's all right. They kill an unarmed black guy. They just come out, you know, 2 hours later, an hour later, they show up with all of their guns and tanks and everything. On the pretension that people are, I mean, it does go to show what guilty consciences they have. The police of Ferguson and of St. Louis County are basically saying, geez, if we were the blacks of this county, we would kill us all. You know, because they are murderers. That's how they think, after all. And so then they assume that all the poor and downtrodden and politically powerless blacks of Ferguson are going to try to kill them all. And so immediately they rush to their tanks, their MRAPs, their armor, their machine guns. And then when that actually is some kind of failure, and for public relations purposes, it actually backfires. Instead of intimidating the poor blacks of Ferguson or anywhere else in America, it only pisses them off more and keeps them outside for 2 weeks, 3 weeks straight, and gets people all over the country walking around with their hands up, don't shoot. And got, you know, center left and center right people talking about rolling back militarism. No problem, no problem. They can benefit from that too. They'll nationalize them. They'll create a national police force that has never existed in America before. You thought the FBI was a national police force. You thought Homeland Security, you know, the DEA and the Treasury's, you know, ATF and other agencies. You thought they were a national police force. What about federally deputizing every sheriff and city policeman in the country? Right now, we have 20-something thousand separate police jurisdictions in America. And yes, they have been blurring them together with their fusion centers and their multi-jurisdictional task forces and their drug task forces and their terror task forces and their every other kind of thing that they can do to try to blur all these old jurisdictional lines as much as they can. But now, in the name of the murder of Mike Brown and the federally paid for and subsidized and trained military response to the people's response to the murder of Mike Brown, they're going to use that, they're going to try to use that as an excuse to nationalize police in America. And, you know, the bill doesn't say nationalize everything about every cop. Well, it's not even a bill yet. It's a proposal. But in effect, that's what it is. I mean, that is not, you know, John Birch Society hyperbole here or anything like that. When there is a czar in the Department of Justice who has federal national power to decide who runs what police precincts or county sheriff's departments and how, then that's it. That is it. That is a single national police force. That is worse than anything that George Bush or Dick Cheney did to establish totalitarianism in America. Okay? If this happens. And oh, Barbara Lee signed on to it. The lady who opposed even the authorization to use force after September 11th at all. The only one. She's for it. The ACLU, the head of the ACLU has signed on to it. Of course, Big Labor has signed on for it because they represent government employees. And they're pushing for this. And there's a huge kernel of truth to Lincoln and LBJ, national government presidents, freed the blacks from the totalitarian circumstances they were living in the 1860s and then again in the 1960s. And so if local, especially in Missouri, if local cops are running roughshod over the rights of blacks, turning to the federal government and the Department of Justice is just a knee-jerk reactionary response by these liberals and progressives. They're just not thinking it through, the real consequences of what that will mean for this country. It'll mean the end of all freedom forever is what it'll mean. It'll mean we all die in a ditch like Shia in front of ISIS. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org and on the Liberty Radio Network. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Imad Adin Ahmad. And he is a longtime libertarian activist, especially affiliated with the Libertarian Party, and runs the Minaret of Freedom Institute at minaret.org, calling the Muslim faithful to freedom. Welcome back to the show. Dean, how are you doing?
Well, thank you, Scott. I'm glad to be back here, and I'm doing well.
Hope good, good. Well, very happy to have you on the show. And, you know, with the two 10-minute segments, we never can really cover everything we want to here. And then with me doing the interview, and that means we jump all around, and it can sometimes be kind of a disaster. But so last time that we spoke, I really wanted to give you a chance to talk about your own personal family history of life in Palestine and now out of it. And, you know, your part in the story of the Nakba, really, and then maybe from there we can get back into some of that very early history of the establishment of Israel, what it's meant for the Palestinians, and then maybe we'll find a way to segue into the current state of pseudo-ceasefire as it exists here. But first of all, can you just tell us about where you're from and how you got here?
Sure. Well, my family is from Palestine. My mother was a resident of Jerusalem, and in fact, her name, Qudsiya, is the feminine form of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. So she was named for the city in which she was born.
I'm sorry, Dean, to interrupt you here, but you just happen to have a pretty bad microphone on your handset. So if you could hold it away from your face and still just talk good and louder. I can control the volume here, but just hold it a little bit back so that we don't get the wind on the mic. I think it'll help.
I understand. Okay, well, is this any better?
Yes, sir. That sounds 100% better. Thank you.
All right, I'll try to keep it where it is. All right, as I was saying, my mother was born in Jerusalem. Her name was Qudsiya. My father was born in a tiny village near there called Bir Nabala. My father had come to the United States when he was a little boy for economic reasons and went back to Palestine in 1947 to find a wife. He wooed and wed my mother in late 1947, but she did not want to come back with him to the United States. She wanted them to stay there, and he agreed at first. But then in May of 1948, the massacre took place at Deir Yassin, and my mother was a teacher, had a student from Deir Yassin, and she was pregnant with me at the time. She decided that maybe it would be best to come to the United States. Because it was not apparently any easier in those days to get a visa than it is now, she didn't get her visa until a month before I was born. And at that time, of course, the airlines wouldn't allow her to fly, being pregnant. So she took a boat, but I was born 10 days premature, so I was born on the boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And when I got to the United States, although technically, I should have been an American citizen since my father was an American citizen and had been for more than 10 years, and since the boat flying the American flag was in technically American soil. Mm-hmm. The immigration official who met my mom simply didn't recognize my citizenship, and so my father had to appeal, and eventually I was given citizenship retroactive to the date of my birth, a very, very strange method of trying to prevent me from running for president, apparently. Uh-huh. Anyway, my extended family includes some people who remained in Palestine, some people who ended up in refugee camps, and some people who fled to other parts of the world, as my mom did, to the United States. So in my own family, you got a pretty much a microcosm of the Palestinian experience. Mm-hmm. For example, I had one cousin who lived in Sweden for a long time before eventually settling in the United States. I have some other cousins who are now businessmen in Amman. And I had some other cousins who are in the refugee camps in Lebanon. So that's, in short, the story of my family. But as you can see, it's not too different from the story of Palestinians in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really something to have been made to be born at sea because you couldn't go back right at the time of the Nakba. So now that means what's exactly the translation there? The disaster, is that right?
Yeah, the catastrophe. Probably the most.
And so that included approximately 750,000 Palestinians who were removed, from their homes in what we now call Israel proper, excluding the Palestinian territories. But so where did all the refugees go? You mentioned Lebanon, and of course there's Gaza and the West Bank, but where else in the world do they have camps that are still full of Palestinian refugees and descendants of those refugees from the Nakba?
Well, there are also camps, some camps in Jordan. There actually, I believe there's still some camps in the occupied territories. And there are also displaced persons in Israel. There are some people who, strangely enough, while not allowed to go to their home villages, are still in Israel, located, you know, perhaps only several miles away from their villages. And then, as I said, like my cousin who was in Sweden, you can really find Palestinians all over the world, not necessarily in refugee camps. That's, I think, probably a minority, although a very large minority of Palestinians. Mm-hmm. There are others who have managed to make their way, you know, successfully. I mentioned my cousins who are businessmen in Amman. My own cousins here in the United States, you know, are all people who are successful financially to one degree or another, but who are separated from their family members. I was raised never having met my grandparents. It was a weird feeling because, you know, all the other kids in my school, most of the other kids were really, really close to their grandparents. I just never met mine.
Now, can you clear up for me a little bit about in Jordan, the Palestinians? I thought that there were, like in Syria, there are laws against them actually competing in the market. They kind of have to stay in the camp and on the dole and aren't allowed to become successful and, you know, anti-competitive laws and that kind of thing, no?
Not in Jordan. Unfortunately, sad to say, in some of the Arab countries, you know, the Palestinians have not been welcome. And there are such problems, but I'm not aware that there are any such laws in Jordan. In fact, the fact that there are no such laws in Jordan is one of the reasons the Israelis have claimed Jordan is the Palestinian state, and there should be no other Palestinian state.
I see.
There are a very large number of Palestinians in Jordan. That can't be denied. But the fact is that they are people who were born across the border and who some of whom still have their homes and others maybe had their homes destroyed, but who would like to go back to their own land.
Right. I guess maybe I was making a bad assumption just on the fact that there are still huge refugee camps for Palestinians in Jordan. It seems like if they don't have to stay in the Palestinian camps, but they could just live in a Palestinian part of town but participate in the society otherwise, then why wouldn't they?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one that unfortunately I can't give the answer to. I do know that on my one trip to Palestine, we visited one of the refugee camps, but it was a social visit. It was not a a fact-finding tour.
Sure.
So I made no investigation into the story of those people of why they were still there, but I think you've got to realize that. There's a combination of factors that might be at play. First off, there's a cycle of poverty. You know, when people are denied, have everything taken away from them, and don't have personal contacts by which they can, you know, become apprentices in some field or another.
So in other words, they're free to leave, but they've got nowhere to go, really.
Exactly.
Right. All right.
Exactly.
Now, I'm sorry. We got to hold it right there, Dean, and take this break. But everybody, sure. Hang tight. We'll be right back with Ahmad Ad-Din Ahmad. I said it wrong. I always do. But minaretoffreedom.org is this great libertarian Muslim website. Check it out. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And latest update I got from antiwar.com is that all is quiet in Gaza now. They have a truce. It's not, I don't know how solid it is or how long it's expected to hold, but it's a bit more than a ceasefire, they're saying, and it seems to be holding for now. We're talking with Ahmad Ad-Din Ahmad. And he's at the Minaret of Freedom Institute. That's minaret.org. And he's a Palestinian-American Muslim libertarian. And we're talking about the history of his family and how it came to be that he's an American is because of the Nakba, the stealing of Palestine by Israel back in 1948. And talking about the plight of the refugees around the Middle East, still living in camps in many places around the Middle East and how they're suffering. And so, but now I guess we got to talk about the recent Gaza war that's been going on for the last couple of months here, basically, but 7 or almost 8 weeks, a very one-sided fighting there, Dean. And then also, you know, there's what is to be done and all of that kind of stuff. So I guess, first of all, can you talk to us about, you know, what do you think we really need to understand about the recent war in Gaza, if you call it that?
Sure. If I might, before I answer that question, I wanted to say one other thing about the refugee camps. Apart from the problems of just getting out of poverty, which is what getting out of the camps is all about, there's also the fact that some people just want to go back home, and they consider that, you know, any economic success they might achieve in this world is only a substitute and not an adequate one for getting what was stolen from them. Mm-hmm. And that also can impede them from getting out of their situation. Sure. Having said that, let's go to your question about Gaza. Now, Gaza is an example of a place that really was and has been called an open-air prison, the largest open-air prison in the world, because of the fact that the Israelis, for many years now, usually with the collaboration of the Egyptians, have cut off the Gazans from being able to deal with the outside world, being able to import, you know, to trade, to get goods that they need in exchange for the goods they produce domestically, unable to get construction materials and so on, all under the excuse of an understandable embargo on weapons. But the fact is that it's not just weapons that have been blockaded from Gaza. Now, what's interesting about this recent warfare there, which caused a lot of pain to both sides, especially to the Gazans, who overwhelmingly had civilians killed as compared to the Israelis. But the reason that that Hamas held out so long for the open-ended peace fire ceasefire that has just been put into effect this week was that they wanted, as a condition of any ceasefire, that this siege be alleviated, that they be allowed to get to trade for the goods they need in order to get construction material, and also for their fishermen to be able to fish in the coastal waters off of Gaza, since, you know, Gaza is a port city. It's a tiny place, a very dense place. It's twice the size of Washington, D.C., but has, millions of people in it. And that fishing is very important to them. So what's fantastic about this current ceasefire and why, from the Gazans' point of view, it has been accepted and so far is holding, is that they've gotten concessions on those points. They are going to be allowed to trade. They are going to be allowed to get construction material. And the fishermen, for the first time, are going to be allowed to go up to 6 miles offshore in order to fish. So this is really the most hopeful ceasefire that has come down so far.
Boy, and at such enormous cost, and I wonder whether, I mean, is there really anything that the Israelis got out of this other than, you know, their bloodlust satiated a little bit?
Well, their intention, they said their intention was to destroy Hamas.
Well, but that was never true. They also said, nah, we don't really mean that because, of course, we don't want to destroy Hamas.
Well, I never believed it, but the fact is, if that was their intention, they utterly failed in that. And then some of us suspected that their intention was just to accelerate the misery of the Gazans in the hopes to drive them out the way that so many other Palestinians have been driven out of the rest of Palestine. Mm-hmm. But they didn't succeed in that either. The Gazans are actually quite surprisingly tough in this matter, mm-hmm. quite awesome and inspiring in their resilience. So what did they get? Well, I think the only thing they got is something they didn't want, that they got a propaganda nightmare. I have never, in all the years of all the atrocities committed by the Israelis, I have never before seen such a degree of criticism from within the United States. For example, just yesterday or very recently, after the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, put an outrageous ad in the Hollywood Reporter in which they quoted Golda Meir saying something to the effect of, we can forgive the Palestinians for killing our children, but we can never forgive them for making us kill their children. Wallace Shawn, the actor and playwright, was so upset by this ad that he published in the Hollywood Reporter, same place that published the ad, an article providing a translation of what the ad really means. And he said basically what the ad really means is that, you know, we're going to try to end the Palestinians' anger against us by killing their children. And he said that, you know, that's crazy. You don't end somebody's anger with you by killing their children.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that is just one example. You know, even on TV, it's because of Twitter, I think, more than anything, people can push right back on reporters about, hey, you just said this, but the proof is opposite, and here's the link, in such an immediate kind of way and in front of everybody that at least the journalists who have some integrity, like Jake Tapper, for example, he's a real reporter, not just a news anchor. He does real journalism. And when people call him to account, he's somewhat accountable. I'm not, you know, I mean, he's a CNN guy, don't get me wrong. But as far as that kind of thing goes, you know,
well, Scott,
people like him are reachable,
decent,
you know?
There have been many decent journalists who have tried to write objectively about this situation in the past, but they don't get past their editors. And the fact that, you know, and that's still true to an extent. I think there was an NBC reporter who got pulled back, called back to the United States after reporting from Gaza about some of the atrocities taking place. But the fact is that, to a degree I've never seen before, editors are allowing little glimpses of what's really going on to get published in the press.
All right, now, we're short on time, so let's skip ahead to how too little too late that all is. The West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem been occupied for 47 years. The West Bank is already, you know, completely colonized, pretty much. It would basically be impossible to have a contiguous separate state there without the Israeli government actually removing all of those Israeli Jewish settlers from those settlements and giving them back to the Palestinians, which is obviously, you know, politically impossible. They're not going to happen. They don't want to do it anyway. And so what's the future now that Kerry's bogus talks have failed again? What's going to happen here? What should happen here?
Well, there's only one thing that's going to resolve this situation, and that is for the United States to end the blank check, the unconditional aid to Israel. As long as that aid is there, and as long as Israel sees it as being unconditional, they have no motive whatsoever to work for a peaceful resolution of the dispute. You can see this one of the most interesting things to me, you've often heard people criticize Hamas because the Hamas charter says they, you know, don't and will never recognize the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. But what you never hear them point out is that the Likud party also shares that view, that they will never recognize a Palestinian state. And why is this never mentioned? It is obviously the sticking point to the same degree that Hamas's intransigence is a problem, so is the Likud's intransigence a problem. Why is this never addressed and dealt with? My answer is because Israel sees that aid as unconditional. As soon as that aid becomes conditional, and as soon as Congress, you know, shows some commitment to the interests of America as opposed to the interests of perceived interests of Israel, then I think you're going to see the Israelis become reasonable and start to negotiate in better faith.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably right. Like to hope so anyway. All right. Well, we're out of time again, but great to have you back on the show, Dean. I sure appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
All right, that is Imad Adin Ahmad. He's at minaret.org, the Minaret of Freedom Institute. We'll be right back. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
How can you shoot women? Children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick right in the heart of that world and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad. And
sorry, y'all, I'm on the phone
saying,
with the LADMV.
Which part
be right back.
Of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this. Okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's the real truth.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
All right. That's Victoria Nuland, U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, basically the Ambassador to the EU, on the phone with Jeffrey Pyatt. I think that audio came out in January. It could have been December. I think January 2014. They're on the phone discussing the form of the new government after they get their coup d'etat regime change in Kiev. And, well, geez, I ought to let it go on, right?
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
Okay, great. So we got the vice president on board. We're tired of screwing around and letting the EU, the Germans, you know, get the job done. So we're going over their head. We're going to work with Ban Ki-moon, and he's going to send one of his sock puppets over here to go around the Europeans and go ahead and push this thing forward on our timetable and with our preferred rank of new quote-unquote officials. in the post-coup junta. And yeah, and we'll get the Vice President Joe Biden to call and make it all stick together, and it'll be great. And we got to move fast, and we got to do it right, because the Russians are going to try to push back, and we got to prevent that at all costs of them doing anything about it. Best laid plans. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and play this clip again, too, because it's good in context, and maybe you want to have them all in one place yourself. Here's Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, clearly speaking from a point of view of a guy who all of his friends are in the State Department or the private version of the State Department, the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is, in other words, he's speaking for the American policy establishment about what's going on in Ukraine. And this was on the night of, I forget if it's the 22nd
it's basically
or the 23rd.
Robin.
No, it's the 24th. I got the date in the title. It's the night of the 24th. Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, goes on the Colbert Report to talk about what's going on in Ukraine.
Uh-huh. It's basically Robin to Russia's Batman. And the challenge here, the challenge here is to try to attract it to the West, to get it to flip sides.
Is America taking sides in this in any way? If these people, the rebels are winning right now, right?
Yes, just
so
recently.
Why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and calling Putin and saying, hey, you might have won the medal count, but we won the country count, biatch.
It's actually a very good question, and the answer is that we don't want Russia to intervene and kick over the table like a game of Risk and take Ukraine back. And so
would they do that? Could he send in troops?
Yes, he could. So we are choosing...
Does Ukraine have any troops of their own? Would they fight back?
Yes, but we don't want this to escalate, and we don't want Russia to crack down. So we want to basically distract Russia. Oh, look, you have the highest medal count. Oh, you did really well. And, you know,
possible?
Focus on the Olympics.
There's a shiny object. Focus we'll just take an entire country away from you.
Basically.
Now, there's a power vacuum right now.
There's a power vacuum. The opposition is all together, which everybody, it's easy to agree on getting rid of the bad old regime and much harder to create a stable country in which everybody compromises and moves forward. The reason we don't want Putin to get involved in this, and so we are basically, we want to try and involve him in this decision so that he allows Ukraine to go. We actually want to not, we want to say, we want a non-exclusive relationship with Ukraine. You can have a relationship with it too.
You're the only one making this into a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship.
Ukraine is basically choosing its future between two completely different courses of action, and we're trying to blur that choice so the old boyfriend doesn't get too upset when it makes the right choice towards
which
us.
Which, of course, is not true. That part is a lie.
He might punch us in the face.
What had happened was the Ukrainians were going to sign a trade agreement with Russia and the Europeans. And the American position was no, it has to only be one or the other ultimatum. And then the president chose the Russians instead, which led to the protest movement and the coup, the Western-backed protest movement and coup. So, but really, you know what? They could have taken this guy's advice and, you know, try to be good sports about it. Try to, okay, you can have a trade agreement with the Russians too. And even after overthrowing the government, they could have played it cool and said, well, listen, okay, we overthrew the government and canceled the results of the last election and everything, but let's try to get along some, right? We still all gotta be Ukraine together, don't we? So, hey, how about it? No, the first thing they did was try to outlaw Russian as a second language. First thing they did is start threatening the people of the East with an anti-terrorist war, and then leaked audio of the gas princess, Yulia Tymoshenko, calling the people of the East foreigners, calling them aliens, saying that she'd like to nuke them. And she's not being realistic. She's basically saying, oh, nuke them all, kind of as a figure of speech. It's like they have nukes to nuke them with. But still, what she was saying was, it's sort of like, you know, when Barry Goldwater said, just saw the entire eastern seaboard off of the country. And then we can be America without them. Well, I can appreciate the sentiment, but that's no way to win an election, dude. Those are your electoral votes right there that you want to saw off. You can't talk about half the country that way. You're sacrificing your presumed right to rule them. So not only did they do a coup, but then they blew it and caused a horrible war and allied with Nazis. And I don't just mean the LADMV either. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, sorry to skip ahead to Ukraine on the show. Everything's all out of order today, but I was on the line with the DMV in L.A. Those bastards. And so I had to hit some soundbite buttons, and then so, hey, look, it's a leaked phone call of America plotting a coup d'etat in Ukraine. Oh, yeah, hey, I know. Let's pretend that we don't know about that. I know, let's pretend that the only thing newsworthy in all of that audio is that Victoria Nuland said a bad word. Did you hear that she used, get this, the F word? What a faux pas. Okay, on to sports and weather and why everything is fine. You don't need to worry about that. Oh, gee, that's funny. I could have swore that is a leaked conversation conspiring of two people in a position to do so, conspiring to overthrow a foreign government, which then was overthrown and took the form delineated in the leaked phone call. And the phone call was leaked before the freaking coup. And then Yatsenyuk became the new prime minister, just like they had said was their plan. Amazing. Oh, no, bad word. What a headline. There's just no excuse for that, too. You know what I mean? If it bleeds, it leads. If it's a controversial bad word that a politician said, oh, that's such a big story. But there's not an actual journalist or newspaper editor or TV news person anywhere in the world who really, I mean, outside of, you know, TMZ or whatever, who really were mostly scandalized by Robert Kagan's wife's use of the F word when the audio is of her plotting a coup d'etat and the overthrow of a foreign government. When they pretend that the F word is the story there, it's because they're liars. And they're lying to you because they have an agenda. And that agenda mostly probably is to keep the federal regulators away. But the way they do that is by carrying the water for the federal government's every narrative. But anyway, so, you know, I admitted this. I told you guys before, Robert Perry, he's a Democrat. I know that. But of all the, you know, Salon.com style, you know, pseudo attacks on libertarianism, his was the absolute most retarded. Oh, all libertarians are libertarians for only one reason. Come on, you know. Because, like Thomas Jefferson, they want to own slaves. Yeah, that's right. I mean, give me a break. That is such a parody of the stupidity of what a liberal cartoonist might write. I mean, Jesus Christ, Tom Tomorrow and Ted Rawl, they don't say that, you know? That wouldn't even fit even in a Ted Rawl cartoon. You'd be like, huh? That's kind of a non sequitur, Ted. I don't really understand. People who are against power are the ones who just want total power. That's it, huh? But that's what Robert Perry wrote. And so I wrote him a big F you, speaking of the F word. I said, what, did you have a stroke or something? What, are you retarded? If that's true, then how come you're my friend? If I'm such a racist bigot who just wants to own slaves, huh? You stupid idiot. But now the problem with that is I'm not really in the libertarian business. I'm in the anti-war business. Well, it's not much of a business, but you know what I mean. And so I don't care if Bob Perry is a stupid Democrat. Of course he's a stupid Democrat. That's why he's so good on the Republicans. That's why he's good on the neocons. He's pretty wishy-washy on Obama. But when it comes to, I don't know, coup d'etats in Ukraine backed by Nazis, Robert Perry is among the best in the world, and yet I wrote him a big FU, accusing him of having a stroke and being worse than half a retard now, and so, you know, I don't know, I guess I could apologize, but then I think, you know, he probably wouldn't accept my apology anyway. But, man, I really shouldn't have burned that bridge. I should have just said, oi, Democrats are so stupid on issues of libertarianism that they don't understand. And then I should have just let it go. Because, man, I could have been interviewing Bob Perry for the last 8 months straight about Ukraine. The last 10 months straight about America's effort to hire a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis to overthrow the government in Kiev to try to pick a fight with Russia. It's incredible. And so I'm an idiot. You should learn a lesson from that. And don't be stupid like Scott Horton and burn your bridges. You know, virtually all of my guests are liberals and progressives and, you know, Marxists of one flavor or another rather than libertarians, because that's mostly who's good on foreign policy. I mean, libertarians are anti-war as hell, but as far as being real factual about it and, you know, really writing about it all the time, it's a bit more fewer and far between there. There are some libertarians, but Robert Perry's contributions to the story of Ukraine this past year at Consortium News, they're hard to beat, man. You know? Justin at antiwar.com has done good. Dan at the Ron Paul Institute has done good, of course. But Robert Perry, man, he's got it right. Big time. And he keeps writing about it over and over again. Of course, his pal, Ray McGovern, too. But yeah, man, I mean, here he is ignoring Ukraine's neo-Nazi stormtroopers. I mean, that should be stupid hyperbole, but it's not. It is not stupid hyperbole, man. It is real. America has hired a bunch of Nazis to fight in the East. And by the way, someone left me a comment over at scotthorton.org saying, man, how come you're not reporting about how the rebels have been kicking the Nazis' asses and wiping the floor with them and all of this? I haven't seen that. I haven't even seen that in RT. And I try to check RT, not that I really rely on it, but at least I'm trying to see what they're saying. And I haven't seen major victories against the Nazis. But I sure have seen plenty of reporting about them doing fighting over there. And, you know, taking some casualties and what have you, but certainly killing people. Like, for example, this one in the Telegraph. Ukraine crisis. The neo-Nazi brigade fighting pro-Russian separatists. Oh, they must be pro-Russian. Otherwise, why would they want to secede from a government run by a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis? How can the Hitler-loving Nazis sit still for this unmitigated aggression of those who would secede from their new Nazi state? But anyway, yeah, and he's got quotes from this, from these guys too. Personally, I'm a Nazi, said Phantom, a 23-year-old former lawyer. I don't hate any other nationalities, but I believe each nation should have its own country. In other words, everybody else get out, including Jews and ethnic Russians and Poles and any other minorities. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Jonathan S. Lande, national security correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Welcome back, Jonathan. How are you?
I am well, thank you very much. A bit tired. Been grinding away on this Syria-Iraq story for a couple months now.
Yeah.
I need a vacation.
Well, now, in Iraq, we could say Kurdistan, Shiistan, and we got the Islamic State, but we need a new name for the rump of what's left of Syria there in the West. Do you have one?
Assadistan?
Oh, there you go, Assadistan, and then bordering on caliphate land. I don't know. Anyway, so, yeah, let's talk about what's going on in Syria, and especially what's going on in the White House and on the National Security Council about what they're going to do in Syria, Jonathan. Go ahead and go.
Well, I wish I could tell you, Scott. That's the big question. You know, after that horrendous videotape of the execution of American freelance journalist James Foley was posted last week by the Islamic State, we got all of this belligerent statements coming out of very senior people in the administration, beginning with the Secretary of State, John Kerry, who said that the Islamic State had to be destroyed. You had the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, saying that the Islamic State is a threat to every interest the United States has. And you had the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, saying that the only way to destroy them, this group, would be to hit them on the Syrian side of the border, which, of course, is what they used to organize and then use as a springboard for their offensive into neighboring Iraq. Then you had, the day after that, you had the Deputy White House National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, saying that the death of James Foley was represented in a terrorist attack on the United States, and he wasn't ruling out any kind of response. And so you take all of that, throw it together, and given the horrific atmosphere that pertained after Mr. Foley's execution, you know, there were a lot of these expectations that were raised that some kind of U.S. military action against the Islamic State inside Syria was imminent. And then come Monday, all that starts getting rolled back by the administration, who are saying, you know, and we're hearing no, there are no imminent airstrikes. And quite frankly, we're not sure what the administration's approach to the Islamic State is going to be. There's a lot of what they, there's a lot they discuss about how they're going to try and approach the problem in Iraq, but Syria remains a black hole.
Hmm. Well, now, so there have been reports that America has been passing intelligence through the Germans to Assad, maybe even through the Iraqi government to Assad. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, that was brought up by it was brought up to administration spokespeople who vehemently deny it. And, you know, I find it a little hard to believe myself because although that kind of thing has happened in the past, we all remember the picture of Donald Rumsfeld meeting Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. To give him American intelligence. But at that time, Saddam Hussein's ouster was not official American policy. The official policy of the Obama administration is that President Bashar Assad of Syria has to go.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard for me to believe that the administration is secretly passing intelligence to Assad on the Islamic State.
Because on the other hand, though, I mean, it's almost impossible to believe that it's the official policy of America to overthrow every last dictator over there who has a clean-shaven chin, Gaddafi and Assad and the secular European-style fascist Baathists, and replace them with these lunatics.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. But let's think about it. If the United States is, in fact, first of all, I suspect that the Assad regime knows a hell of a lot more about the Islamic State and its order of battle and where it is and what it controls than the United States of America does. So you got to ask the question, why would Assad need our intelligence?
Right.
Second of all, by helping him, we're not just helping someone who today is being cited by the United Nations, whose regime is being cited by the United Nations as committing just unbelievable war crimes. But by helping him, or by at least going against helping him against the Islamic State, we're helping inadvertently another entity, and that would be Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, which is the official al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And I don't think that is American policy. Right. So I really do have a bit of a problem believing that the United States is passing intelligence. Is the United States maintaining some kind of communications channel through another intelligence service like the Germans or the Russians to the Assad regime? I have no problem believing that. But the idea that we're actually trying to help Assad deal with an enemy that he knows better than we do is hard for me to understand.
Mm. All right. Now, I'm sorry. Could you go over that again, how it is that if he was helping Assad target ISIS, oh, you're saying that that would just, in effect, help Nusra since they're fighting ISIS, too, and we wouldn't want to do that? But that
right.
would be kind of a minor side effect compared to
well, it
helping...
would, except it, well, I don't know, because, look...
I mean, if
the
there's
places...
one force in the country that is the anti-ISIS force that could be, it would be the Assad government, not Nusra.
Well, but both are fighting the Islamic State, and in particular, Nusra is fighting the Islamic State and trying to prevent it from taking over Aleppo, the country's largest city and commercial center. There are some pretty fierce battles going on. So, you know, I don't find it... I just said it would be an inadvertent advantage that we
right.
would be
yeah,
giving.
Yeah, I see what you mean, though.
But I don't think it would be the number one
right.
consideration now, for the Obama administration.
Right. Now, okay, we're real short on time here, so let me ask you this real quick. There's another story at McClatchy here by your colleague, Leslie Clark, and the quote from Obama is, "Let me say it again. American combat troops will not be returning to fight in Iraq. Will
yep.
not allow the United States to be dragged back into another ground war." And that sounds like a little bit of wisdom there, that he understands that ISIS wants us to invade the Sunni Triangle. And he's saying he knows better. Do you think he'll really stay out? Because, you know, Prothero says JSOC, SOCOM, and CIA have been running around in Kurdistan for months.
Yeah, but they're not American combat boots. Let's
well,
forget.
Sort of, kind of.
Well,
I mean, Delta
but,
Force
yeah, but,
and...
But every administration, every government in the world plays funny with words. Right, and
right.
and so and don't forget we've been told that there would be no American boots on the ground in Syria, and yet there were in July in this failed rescue attempt to try and get James Foley.
Mm.
So you know, their words can be played with, and they are all the time. And let's not also forget that there are nearly 1,000 Americans, American military, in Iraq already as a result of the offensive that was launched by the Islamic State and the request that was made by what's will be soon, I guess, the former Maliki government for American military advisors. And they've got them, and they've got their additional American security contingents over there at the request of the State Department, which wants to make sure that there's no threat to Baghdad airport, because that's the way that the Americans would get out. And so the American troops are helping to provide security there for the embassy, for the consulate in Erbil. I believe there's also a consulate down in Basra that is where there's been increased security. And so there are American troops in Iraq. The question is whether or not those are going to increase. And I think a lot of that has to do with, I think a lot of people are looking forward to next month and this 30-day deadline that the Iraqi Prime Minister designate al-Abadi has to form a new government, a quote-unquote inclusive government with the Kurds and the Sunnis that I think the administration sees as being, I know the administration sees as being the key to solving the Islamic State problem in Iraq, and a lot of people have major questions about that.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous. You can just, you know, place your shorts on it right now.
Right.
On the markets there. Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate your time.
Anytime, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is Jonathan Landay, McClatchyDC.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, guys and girls, welcome back to the thing, man. Now, Landay had to go, so I can't ask him no more questions. Any more questions? Sorry, I can hear my mom in my ear. Any more questions? Okay, sorry. Blame me for my own bad grammar. It's no one else's fault. All right, many of you know this, and many of you have heard me say this many times, but many of you are new around here, and you might not know, and I think it's worth telling you that Jonathan Landay, you should know about him, that starting right after September 11th, he and his colleagues at Knight Ridder Newspapers debunked every lie told about Iraq, for all intents and purposes, virtually all of them, for a year and a half. Before the war started. And in fact, just yesterday, 2 days ago, what's the date? Yeah, yesterday was the anniversary of Dick Cheney's Veterans of Foreign Wars speech. There's a blog about it by Ray McGovern today. Well, it's mentioned in there. But Dick Cheney went to the Veterans of Foreign Wars in August of 2002, 12 years ago yesterday, and he just lied his ass off. He just outright lied. And later on, as Ray McGovern points out, Anthony Zinni, who was the former commander of CENTCOM, okay, was the top general for all the land between Israel and India, said that when he heard Dick Cheney's speech, he was like, what are you talking about? That none of that is true. That's not what the intelligence says. Later on, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, said he thought, what? What are you talking about? That's not true. That's not what the intelligence says. Anyway, they went along. Part of the reason that I was so hip to what was going on with the Iraq thing was I did not understand. I had not been reading Raimondo and Rothbard my whole life. I did not know about the sect of neoconservatives. But I did know that there were hawks all through the 90s who said that Bush Sr.'s big failure was he didn't go all the way to Baghdad and how they weren't over it. And I was a very Ron Paulian on the issue of all of Clinton's blockade and bombings and Operation Desert Fox and the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998 and all of that kind of thing. And then right after September 11th, I saw where, well, and look, we all heard, you know, oh, the anthrax attacks, according to Brian Ross at ABC News, must be from Iraq. It must have been Saddam did the anthrax and blah, blah, blah. All that started right away. But also, I remember reading William Sapphire of MJ Rosenberg threatening fame from yesterday's show. Longtime columnist at the New York Times, wrote an article called The Big Mo. And it was reprinted in the Austin American Statesman. And what it was a letter to George Bush basically saying, attack Iraq right now. Everyone is with you. You can do anything you want to anyone you want. Get Saddam. Get him. Get him. And there's, and in the essay, and I even actually went and looked this up and reread it two or three years ago now, I guess. And if I remember it right, it's about, he says in there, there is a group of people in Washington who just know that this must be the next thing. Like, obviously we got to go to Afghanistan first, but then Iraq, we got to hit Iraq. And he was even saying, go ahead, hit him at the same time, rolling start, get it going. And he was speaking for Richard Perle et al., the neoconservative movement, Dick Cheney and his hawks. And so it was, you know, it was like H.G. Wells, the open conspiracy blueprint for world revolution. Yeah, it's all right there at pnac.org. You know, there it is, a premeditated murder plot announced right there on TV. And yeah, they lied into war, and Sam Gardner, you know, all the weapons of mass destruction, all that. We could get into all the details of the aluminum tubes and the uranium and the germs and this and that. But the most important lie was that Saddam did the attack. But only Dick Cheney and then lower neocons than him would outright tell that lie. Bush would not tell that lie. Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, the National Security Advisor, and all of her staff, they would not say that. It was too not true. And they didn't want to be caught saying that. Dick Cheney, you know, would like us to believe that he believed that Saddam met with Mohammed Atta in Prague in the Czech Republic But the fact that he called it Czechoslovakia is one clue that he's completely lying his ass off. And the CIA debunked that lie in real time at the time, too. But anyway, the rest of the cabinet deliberately lied and said Saddam did 9/11, even without saying Saddam did 9/11. And it was Karl Rove and the White House Iraq Group came up with the scheme, and Colonel Sam Gardner talks about it. They used the excluded middle tactic, where George Bush would be asked, you know, what's the emergency? How come if the axis of evil includes Iran and North Korea and all that, how come we got to do Iraq right now? What is it with that? And he would say, we have to attack Iraq because of September 11th. Because on September 11th, we learned that from now on, we got to start all the wars. Or else, you know, something bad could happen here, and we're just not going to tolerate that risk. Right? Not that, man, we all learned that day that we should cut our own guts out with swords because of our horrible failure and 3,000 counts of criminally negligent homicide on our head. Nope, the lesson was, we have to start wars from now on. Now, it sounded like he was saying, because Saddam did it. Why attack Saddam? Why attack Iraq? Because of September 11th. But he didn't say, because they did September 11th, and we have to get revenge for that. Of course, if that was true, we would have attacked them when William Safire said to attack them in the fall of 2001. They wouldn't have screwed around lying to you about germ weapons for a year and a half and asked permission from the French and the Russians if it was revenge for the attack. They would have just done that immediately. But they did succeed in creating enough confusion in people's minds. I mean, mostly people understood that Saddam and Osama were different men, but it didn't seem to be in question that they were in cahoots. And that it was only a miracle that Saddam did not equip Al-Qaeda with enough material to nuke us on 9/11 or whatever. That was the narrative, and they knew they were lying, and they were lying. But anyway, Jonathan Landay was debunking them starting right then. Everything they said about Saddam's ties to Osama, everything they said about the weapons of mass destruction, the fact of that separate government, as Colin Powell later called it, the Dick Cheney neocon network, the Douglas Feith's Gestapo office is what Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State at the time, called it. They got the name wrong. Landay called it the Office of Special Projects. It was actually the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith and Abram Chulsky at the Pentagon, coming up with the lies to lie into war. But they also got them on the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, which sounds like it's stupid and boring, but no, it's Douglas Feith and Michael Maloof making up lies about Saddam and Osama, digging through the CIA's trash and coming up with lies about Saddam and Osama, including the one about, never mind the CIA debunking it, yes, here's reason to believe that Mohammed Atta met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague, which is, of course, total nonsense. In fact, Michael Isikoff did a great thing for Newsweek called the Special White House Slideshow, and if you put in Isikoff White House slideshow and Feith, it'll come up. You may need that. I've had trouble finding it a couple of times, but it's on there at Newsweek. And it's about how somebody let Doug Feith tell George Bush that Saddam did 9/11 for 5 or 10 minutes one day. I don't know if they told him to believe it or not, but they let Feith have direct access to the president to give the Atta in Prague lie time. But anyway, Landay had him busted completely. And you watch a documentary about this. In fact, you can find the archives at McClatchy, D.C. You got to kind of Google around. Go, site McClatchyDC.com, Landay 2001, because they bought, McClatchy bought Knight Ridder and got all those documents, all those news stories, and they kept them. They archived them. It's on McClatchyDC.com. You can find them. And in fact, also, if you watch the documentary Buying the War by Bill Moyers, you'll see Landay and his partner Strobel and the other guy died, Galloway, Joe Galloway, I think was his name, or no. I forget the guy's name. Anyway, he was a columnist, but he was, you know, right on about everything. And then the Buying the War at PBS, now with Bill Moyers, they have links to a lot of those original articles too, debunking this stuff. And so 12 years ago, when Dick Cheney gave his VFW speech saying Saddam Hussein is going to kill us all with chemical and germ weapons if we don't start the war against him first, Jonathan Landay came out with a piece the next day saying, oh yeah, well, I'm talking to CIA guys who are telling me that that's not true. You know, part of their problem, this is in buying the war, part of Landay's problem was he was sort of kind of nobody at Knight Ridder. If he had been a Washington Post guy, he would have had access to all the best liars. Instead, he was talking to the actual professional intelligence guys, and they were saying, dude, you wouldn't believe the crap they're pushing. Let me show you. The guy's name is Feith. You're going to want to look into him. All right. Back in a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys. Oh, I screwed up, didn't I? I forgot to call him. Ha! All right, well, here's Paul Montgomery talking about burning the Japanese to death.
Between them.
I was 21 years old, and I really was wanting to get the war over, and I wanted to get home. And if they told me to go bomb some cities, I went and bombed cities. And they were bombed to nothing left except steps and chimneys. Complete 100% obliteration. It's not like going out and sticking a bayonet in somebody's belly, okay? You still kill them, but you kill them from a distance. And it doesn't have that demoralizing effect upon you.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Yeah, a little filler audio for you there because I'm screwing up. But yeah, I'm, well, it's me, Scott Horton, my show, the Screw Up Show, the Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all sticking with it. And good thing you did too, because next up is the great Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. He writes up everything important that happens and what you really need to know about it. All day, every damn day, at news.antiwar.com. You got to read each and every last bit of it. That's what I say. Hey, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
Good, good. Happy to have you back here. Now, so let's talk about what we know and what we don't know about what is going on in Ukraine right now. According to Vox, and they only do facts, no context, they say, let's be clear, Russia is invading Ukraine right now. They're just not calling it that. So, is that right?
Well, it seems to be right that 10 Russian troops strayed across the border yesterday. But I don't know that 10 constitutes an invasion. It sounds like they were only a few yards across the unmarked border in one of the areas in between the cities, and they got picked up by Ukrainian border patrol. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly Ukrainian officials are trying to make this out as an invasion and some sort of special operations mission that the Russians are trying to carry out behind their back. But to me, 10 people does not an invasion make.
Well, you know, I saw them joking yesterday on Twitter saying, oh, yeah, well, I guess, would you believe my GPS broke or whatever? How could they possibly accidentally cross the border? They must have been up to something, no good.
Well, I mean, a lot of borders in the world are like this. They're just not marked. I mean, it's not. Some borders are very, very obvious. I mean, the U.S.-Mexico border, it would be awful difficult to stray across that border in most parts without knowing it. But the Ukraine-Russian border, which wasn't even a border during the Soviet era, I mean, it. There are checkpoints along the roads, but if you're in between those roads and not within visual sight of any roads, you're not going to see any identifying marks saying that you're at the border. Mm-hmm. So it really would be pretty easy if you're patrolling that border to accidentally stray across one side or the other without even knowing it.
Yeah, it's a real strange situation there. So, I guess, what can you tell us about the fighting recently in the breakaway provinces there? Even tell us what you don't know, what the sides claim and what turns out to not be provable, or any kind of context you can give us to what's really going on.
What we don't know is a lot more than what we do know about the fighting, because so many of these claims, particularly from the Ukrainian government, turn out to just be nonsense. They appear to have taken part of Luhansk. They continue to shell Donetsk, although there's been some counteroffensives and some reports by the rebels that they've made some gains fighting back against the military. Exactly where it stands, I don't think anybody really knows, and the official statements from both sides are always pretty dubious.
Right. Yeah, you know, I'm watching this thing at the New York Times right now out of the corner of my eye, where this guy supposedly is supposedly a Russian, admitting that, he said he didn't know when he crossed the border, but he knew that was the plan. But, you know, for all the nonsense that's come out of Kiev, I don't even know if this is really a Russian soldier or what, you know? I don't know, they have a dog tag, but I wouldn't know how to compare a Russian versus Ukrainian dog tag.
Right, and who's to say it's his dog tag when he's making statements? We saw not that long ago Ukraine claiming to have destroyed an entire column of armored Russian vehicles inside the Ukraine that had invaded. It was sort of a curious story at the time because they were touting this, but they didn't say exactly where it was, and they provided no pictures or anything. And after a few days of bragging about this destruction of this phantom column, which Russia said never happened, Ukraine finally dropped the story, too, and even claimed that they never said that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing about it. You know, Eric was telling me that really everything we hear from Rasmussen, Anders Fogh Rasmussen there, the head of NATO, that really all he does is just repeat whatever the Kiev government says. So the New York Times headline might read, NATO says Russia invades Ukraine, but then it turns out that NATO is just, you know, parroting a proven, obvious liar.
For example,
you're saying about the attacks on the Russian columns that never happened, that they claimed over and over again. They said, yeah, we obliterated them with artillery overnight. I mean, you knew they were lying right there. How'd you hit them at night with artillery and you got every last vehicle, huh?
Right, and you're talking 50-plus-year-old Soviet artillery, which isn't known for its incredible accuracy. The idea that they could wipe out an entire armored column with no resistance was laughable in the first place, and the fact that they never showed pictures and eventually dropped the story entirely reflects how crazy a lot of the stories coming out of Ukraine right now are.
Yeah.
I mean, even the U.S. State Department, which for a long time has taken whatever Ukraine says at face value and reported it as unquestionable fact, including while Russia was complaining about the 1 million people displaced in the east, repeating the Ukrainian government's claim that they think a lot of those people were just visiting family. Even the State Department is now, you know, when that column story came out, the U.S. first reported it, but then the State Department, when they were asked about it, said they couldn't really confirm that it happened. So I think there's an increasing understanding that a lot of what Ukraine says is just nonsense, and that echoing it is going to be embarrassing a few days down the road when it turns out not to be true.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's really a horrible thing that NATO is not just a treaty, a system. It's its own centralized bureaucracy with its own, you know, institutional reasons for trying to expand all the time. And, I mean, this is almost unbelievable to me that in the middle of this crisis, the Guardian headline reads, NATO plans East European bases to counter Russia. And they're talking about putting them in the Baltic states, and I don't know. I guess eventually Belarus, if they think they can get away with it. Maybe that's, you know, in another couple of years.
Well, and Poland has been pushing pretty heavily for this. Mm-hmm. Not so much because there's a serious military threat to Poland, because there's not, but rather because Poland assumed there would be a substantial foreign military presence there when they joined NATO. They figured it would get them a lot of foreign aid, and it really hasn't panned out that way. So they're really pushing hard on this Ukraine crisis as an excuse, trying to come up with the idea that all of a sudden Russian tanks are going to start pouring into Central Europe, and that they want to have military bases in Poland to prevent that.
Crazy. All right, I'm sorry. Hold it right there, Jason. We got to take this break. We'll be right back. Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com about the situation in Ukraine. And, well, one of these headlines here from the bottom of the page, Jason, is about the talks going on that Poroshenko and Putin are talking personally, apparently, directly with each other. Can you fill us in on that, how long this has been going on, and whether there's any reason to be optimistic that they can have some kind of ceasefire in the near term?
Well, it started yesterday, and they're meeting in Belarus. Certainly the goal for the talks was to negotiate some sort of ceasefire, but right now it's not really clear if Poroshenko even wants a ceasefire. Ukraine's kind of made a lot of the idea that they're winning this war, and they don't seem to want any ceasefire that doesn't include unilateral surrender by the other side. So I'm not all that optimistic that they're going to come up with a deal, especially now that the 10 Russian troops that they captured is the big headline in Ukraine, and I think that'll probably be the main focus of the talks, is trying to secure their release.
Right. Well, and again, assuming that that's even true, but I guess, are the Russians disputing it, or?
No, and the Russian Defense Ministry issued a statement confirming that some of their troops had strayed across the border by mistake.
Well, that one guy's going to be in trouble, because whatever happened to name, rank, and serial numbers, he's going on and on about it. Assuming he's one of the 10 again, but it would be the first time the Kiev government told the truth about something, but there's a first for everything. Well, so now if that is putting the kibosh on the peace efforts, then what about the opposite of that? Has Putin, I guess he's too smart to have really drawn a red line out loud and dared the Kiev government to cross it. But, I mean, is the Western side confident that he's just going to sit there and let Donetsk and Luhansk eventually be crushed?
Well, the Western side has been confident for months that he wasn't going to do that, and has been predicting an imminent Russian invasion of Ukraine pretty much on a weekly basis since June. But it really hasn't happened, and even though there's constant talk of buildups along the border, there really isn't any sign that Russia is going to go in there. I don't think Russia wants that, because Donetsk and Luhansk are fairly unappealing cities. I mean, they're sort of the equivalent of the U.S. Rust Belt. There's a lot of steel manufacturing and things like that really haven't been very profitable for Ukraine, and would be even less profitable in Russia, which already has a substantial steel industry. Going in there to try to stop this would probably mean eventually annexing that region, and I don't think Russia wants it. It's too poor, and it's not of any real value to them.
Yeah. Well, and as far as the refugees go, they've been flowing by the hundreds of thousands all this time, so I guess that's... They haven't
right.
announced
and,
it, but
Russia
does it look like that's really the policy?
Russia can easily absorb a million refugees. I mean, I guess not easily, but there's no shortage of room in Russia to do that, and most of these people are ethnic Russians, so...
Well, and that's the message that the people of the East are getting from Russia, right? Is that we're not coming to help you. If you want to run, you can run, but we're not coming. Is that right?
Well, they've been sort of getting a mixed message. Early on, Russia was very much public about, we stand with the people of eastern Ukraine. We're not going to allow violence against ethnic Russians anywhere in the world. And as time's gone on and... Ukraine has been so reluctant to accept any sort of ceasefire deal. They've sort of backed off on that, and now they're kind of mum on what their intentions are. But I think their lack of action speaks a lot louder than anything else, and it's pretty clear that they're not going to intervene militarily.
Yeah. Well, now, so... I think I knew this about a week ago, correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, is this right, that basically the town in Donetsk that has been the government buildings and that kind of thing have been taken by the Kiev government, but now they're working on Luhansk, is that right, with the siege there?
Well, I'm not really sure about that. Certainly, the Kiev government had taken parts of Donetsk, they've held the airport. They've taken some of the government buildings. I'm not sure if they hold that entire district or not.
Mm.
They've been pretty heavily shelling the residential areas around that district. Luhansk does seem to be the focus, though, because that's closer to the Russian border. That's when Russia sent humanitarian aid in last week. That was the route through which it came in was by way of Luhansk.
Right. And then, so what do we know about casualties? Is anybody keeping count? The Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe?
Not reliable counts. We've had figures in the few thousands, but because of the sort of fog of war that's descended over eastern Ukraine, which... I mean, we're all familiar with how hard it is to get reliable casualties out of places like Iraq and Syria, but that coupled with Ukraine's sometimes crazy proclamations that turn out to not be true, we really don't have any good casualty figures. There have been times where Ukraine's claimed to have killed 500 or 600 rebels in an afternoon, and in places that it doesn't seem plausible they would have even had that many rebels. So we really don't have good figures at all.
Hmm. And then it was a pretty big deal, I thought, that the Pentagon announced that, you know, criticism that the Kiev government was attacking the eastern, you know, separatist regions, I guess you could call them, with ballistic missiles with, I forget, was it 500, 1,000-pound, obviously conventional warheads, but... that these are, you know, basically pretty indiscriminate, like Saddam and his Scuds kind of thing.
Right. And it was sort of weird because the Pentagon made that statement, but a lot of the private comments out of defense officials were that they weren't going to offer any particular details on what those ballistic missiles were targeting, exactly where they were hitting, what they were doing. Because Ukraine is the good guys, and it's a paraphrase, but that was basically the quote they were giving to places like the Washington Post, that they didn't want to make Ukraine's military out to be portrayed in negative light.
Yeah, I wonder why they even said anything publicly about it at all.
Yeah, so sometimes when they talk about things, it's kind of puzzling why it gets released in the first place. When they don't expect to provide any details at all.
Yeah, and it's completely contrary to the rest of what they're up to. But anyway. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time on the show again, Jason. Phone us in on this mess.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Appreciate it. That's Jason Ditz, everybody. News.antiwar.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I like this song. I don't want to interrupt it. I'd rather listen, but it's getting quieter and quieter as we go here anyway. All right, y'all, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, I don't know. Let's see, we got Ukraine. We got Gaza. We got the Islamic State, and we got the police state. And you know, when we talk about ISIS and all of that, there's the how we got into this mess has got to be covered pretty much every damn day, as well as the what's going on. Again, well, you know what? Here. Let me find the exact Roosevelt quote and the exact Wilson quote. I should have already done this during the break, but I only just thought of it. FDR, Boys, Foreign Wars. I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars, he said. And then, of course, Wilson said he kept us out of war was his slogan for re-election in 1916. But there's also the promise of no foreign wars. Wilson promised no foreign. I'm trying to remember the exact quote off the top of my head. I think I know it, but I just can't recall it. Oh, I should have the quote. Any quote. Promise no foreign wars. The lies and racism of Woodrow Wilson. That looks like a lot of fun. And there's always remembering with astonishment Woodrow Wilson's war against liberty in the name of freedom by Joe Stromberg. That's always a good one. But wait a minute, where is the Wilson quote, promise, no foreign war? Maybe I need to drop war, foreign out of there. That's too specific. So, where's the quote of Woodrow Wilson? Okay, he kept us out of war was his campaign re-election slogan. I mean, that's pretty good, but no, I mean, I really would rather have the quote. The exact quote. Oh, well, whatever. So here's Obama doing like Wilson and doing like FDR. Let me say it again. American troops will not be returning to fight in Iraq. Yes, SOCOM is there and JSOC is there and CIA is there. Approximately 1,000 of them. Maybe more. We got drones, we got planes flying. And here's the thing I didn't get to talk about with Jonathan Landay that I wanted to, is I saw Michael Scheuer on Fox News. Lou Dobbs. I thought he was on CNN. I guess Lou Dobbs is on Fox now. And so he's interviewing Michael Scheuer. And if you're familiar with Michael Scheuer, he's a former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. And he's a conservative, and he's kind of a hawk on Al-Qaeda, although he's also a Ron Paulian in the way. It's a bit of a complicated message because he's not a libertarian. But basically what he's saying is, if we would stop intervening over there, the terrorism problem would dry up. That's the best way to solve this problem is to stop creating it because we created it. American foreign policy created the terrorist problem that we have to deal with. On the other hand, he says, yeah, but of course we got to kill all the ones we created so far. but just hopefully in a way where we don't make it worse. Anyway, so he can be better on this show than he is on Fox News. Can I put it that way? He can play into Lou Dobbs's weaknesses sometimes. But so when Lou Dobbs, can you believe we're switching back to fight on the side of Assad? He was saying it from a conventional wisdom Israeli point of view. Assad bad, blah, blah. And you know Michael Shorey don't buy into that. But he agreed. That's the wrong, and he's not a non-interventionist, a pure non-interventionist libertarian or anything. Actually, non-intervention.com is his website. But it's not that he is opposed. He's Michael Scheuer, right-wing conservative American nationalist, and he is for exploding Al-Qaeda and or ISIS-type guys to death on any given occasion. And you might think, I might think, that he would have said to Lou Dobbs, we should back Assad, because Assad is the best hope we've got of killing these guys in Syria. Assad is a secularist, an Alawite, a fascist, a brutal dictator, and a useful one to us, just like we should have kept Saddam, that kind of thing. Because that's the kind of thing that he says. But you know what he said to Lou Dobbs? He said, no, we should not be backing Assad. And not because of these bogus Israeli reasons, but because, they're crocodile tear pretend reasons either. But because that puts us, just like when we're backing the new government in Baghdad, that puts us back on the side of Iran and the Shiites, which is not sure to gain us any actual victory over the Islamic State, but is guaranteed to absolutely drive them into a rage. And not only are they fighting the United States, but the United States is helping Iran and the Shiites against them. And it will radicalize even more people to their cause, and it'll make them full of even more insane hatred for the United States. And so, in other words, Obama is just drawing a target on us all. And I believe, and I don't mean to put words in the man's mouth, but you've heard Michael Shorey say controversial things before, I think. I believe that there's a hypothetical that you could construct where he would be for some kind of war to destroy the Islamic State. But even he is up against, yeah, but who are you going to get to do it for you? The Republicans or the Democrats? This Pentagon? This CIA? This government? They're going to go over there and they're going to get what right? They're going to side with the Shiites? In what the Islamic State is trying to sell as an Islamic civil holy war? No, no, no. Don't do it, he said. So you see my point. Here's a guy who's a hawk. This is not a guy who is just a dove and a peacenik who says give peace a chance or that kind of thing. He said horrible things about, in the past, if we got to kill everybody who happens to be around, every last Al-Qaeda guy in Pakistan, well, we ought to just do that then, and that kind of thing. I mean, he said very extreme things about just how far he's willing to see the U.S. military go in hunting down and killing anybody who ever liked Osama in any way, so to speak. And here he is saying, no, all you can do here is screw this up. All you can do here is make more enemies for the American people without actually solving any problems. For God's sake, and he's been saying all along, don't back the Mujahideen against Assad. And now when he has the opportunity to maybe say, do the smart thing and turn back to Assad, he says, no, don't do that either. Just quit it. You back Assad, you're back in Iran. It's the same thing we're already doing in Iraq. Again, when we're backing the Iraqi government, that's just a bogus term for the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigades and Muqtada al-Sadr and their Shiite murderer friend with the Ayatollah Alliance. And in doing so, we're just making matters that much worse. And the fact, in fact, I'm following one of these at least pro-ISIS guys on Twitter, a few of them. I don't know who they all are. Maybe they're tweeting from Langley and, from the Pentagon. But what was I going to say he was talking about? I forgot. It was some stupid. These guys are a bunch of jackasses anyway. They do deserve to be exploded, but just America shouldn't do it. That's the real damn point. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, The Scott Horton Show. We got to get back to the police state section here. If you ever heard of the campaign, Support Your Local Police, that's the John Birch Society. Right-wing super patriots. And their real point, at least was, I don't know. At some point, their point was not that your local cops are perfect, but that there's a campaign to demonize them afoot that has a purpose, a nefarious, horrible America-ending purpose, to nationalize them, to pretend that only federal oversight can make them fair and nice and a bunch of crap. Like you expect because you watch TV. And, which is, of course, contrary to exactly what police agencies actually are. So, kind of implausible. That'll happen to my levels here. Check. Anyway. So, that was their whole point. Support your local police. Now, William Norman Grigg, former editor of the John Birchers magazine, who left their organization because he's great on everything and they became absolutely horrible on the southern border police state and got rid of them. He came to the conclusion shortly thereafter that no, not support your local police. That doesn't mean necessarily support for any national program to replace them or normalize them or centralize them or anything like that necessarily either. But these guys are out of control. They are the local police forces, the county and city police forces in America are the single greatest threat to the life and liberty of the American people. Far more than crime, far more than any of the terrorist attacks their government provokes against them or anything else. The local police are deadly dangerous, out of control, completely out of control. And here's just a few examples. Philadelphia earns millions by seizing cash and homes from people never charged with a crime. And they compare them to LA and other major metropolitan areas where they also have a policy of stealing as much private property as they can through civil forfeiture. And in Philadelphia, they're just completely outside the norm. They steal, $6-7 million a year worth of property from people without any criminal charges ever being filed. They're just gangsters. If you know what civil forfeiture is, well, yeah, that's what they're doing. If you don't know, really look into it. You won't believe that they can get away with this in the USA. This is at Forbes.com. It's the Koch's Institute for Justice is suing Philadelphia to try to put a stop to this. But it is outright most ruthless, mirrored sunglasses, kleptocracy type gangsterism that ought to have no place in America at all. Just on the face of it. Hang on, more coughing. All right. And then dead people everywhere. It's not just Mike Brown here. Georgia cops tasered this guy 13 times, used it as a cattle prod to force him to walk. He fell down dead. They killed him. Black man in Georgia. Well, they chased him and caught him. And he said, I'm too tired, I can't. They wouldn't let him stop and rest for one moment. And they electroshock tortured him to death. And, come on, say it with me now, none of them will be held accountable at all in any way. That's right, because there is no such thing as the rule of law. There never really was. And then L.A. cops ignored asthmatic suspects' pleas before death. You can talk so you can breathe. Well, what could he? What was he saying? I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I have asthma. I have asthma. He was dying. They brought him to jail, threw him on the ground. He turned to a corpse. And then the lawyer for the Ohio man says he wasn't pointing the BB gun at anybody. He was shot on sight. He was leaning on the BB gun like a cane. I believe his family's lawyer. And he's going off the surveillance video. He's not going by anybody's testimony. He's going by what the video shows. A black guy was at a Walmart in Ohio. You're going to think I'm lying. He was at a Walmart in Ohio. He got a BB gun from the toy section, was going to buy it. Was sitting there talking on his cell phone to his girlfriend, who was at his parents' house at the time, and leaning on it like a cane, someone called 911. Listen, you might need to sit your mom down at the kitchen table and explain this. You call 911 on someone, you're not calling Officer Friendly to come and make sure everything is okay. You are calling the Nazi stormtroopers of death who can't wait for a chance to kill anyone. That's real. And that's what happened here. With some lady said, oh no, a black man with a toy gun. I feel a little uncomfortable. So she called 911 and they came and they killed him. They killed him. It was a BB gun from the toy section at Walmart. He wasn't even holding it. He was leaning on it like a cane, a toy gun that he was going to buy. Can you imagine if that was your son or your brother? The cops killed your brother today. I'm sorry, what? But my brother's no criminal. How in the world could that be? Well, he was shopping for a BB gun at Walmart, and so they killed him. But then here's the thing. What do they want to do? They want to use judo on you. They want to take your outrage and say, yeah, if only there was a justice and equality of enforcement czar at the Department of Justice. Equitable policing. That's the only way to do it. This is what we got to do. That's what they're calling for. To nationalize the local and federal, local and state. Well, I don't know. They're not actually calling out the state governments here, but the county and city police agencies. They're basically talking about nationalization here. And this is a real thing. And I don't know if you know this or not. I mean, I don't mean to be patronizing and rude, but I think, hey, it bears pointing out that no, really, the word czar is the Russian word for Caesar, for emperor. Like in the Roman Empire, where the emperor was a dictator and the republic was dead. And the evil empire was ruled by an emperor. In Germany, they say Kaiser. In Russia, they say Tsar. And it started out that, hey, America is such a limited, lawful, constitutional republic type of a place that it's sort of a flip and sarcastic way of saying, well, we're just hiring a technocrat to implement this policy our democracy has decided on. So, yes, it's kind of a cutesy thing to call this or that agent of the national government a czar, the health czar, the housing czar, the drug czar. But now you see what's happened is all the irony's worn off it. And now, yeah, no, really, that's what they mean. They mean the end of the rule of law in the name of the rule of law. And, you know, we already all know that the reason you don't even have to be taught. No one has to be taught. You do not even have to sit your mom down at the kitchen table and teach her that the reason that things are as bad as the way they are now with the cops is because of the federal government's war on drugs. and militarization program of giving all this military equipment and military training to the local cops. Everybody knows that. There's no other explanation. That's part of who we are. Like, yeah, we exist somewhere between Canada and Mexico. Yeah, the federal government's drug war, the federal government's military equipment, the federal government's military training, the federal government's unitary executive of lawless authority is what has brought us to this. And now you're telling me that centralizing them all under the Department of Justice is the way to fix it? And go look at BuzzFeed. You won't even believe me. I don't expect you to believe me. Go read this and weep yourself. It's at BuzzFeed.com. National progressives want a federal czar to oversee local police. They're not calling for an end to militarization, just maybe a cut in the rate of growth. And they're not calling for the Bill of Rights, just equitable policing. So that everybody is as enslaved as poor blacks are now.